Radio EcoShock.
We pick up our conversation with well-known scientist Dr. Kevin Trenberth, distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and author of the new climate guide, The Changing Flow of Energy Through the Climate System. Let's dive into the big system in the Pacific Ocean that drives so much of the weather we've been seeing in the Americas, Europe, and beyond. TV weathercasters point to La Niña or El Niño, but scientists call it ENSO, and that includes another pattern change, the SO part, the Southern Oscillation. Kevin, what is the Southern Oscillation, and why is it grouped with La Niña and El Niño?
Yes, so the ENSO phenomenon, the El Niño and Southern Oscillation phenomenon, is the largest form of natural variability that occurs on the planet. It involves the entire Pacific Ocean, and that's the El Niño part. El Niño refers to a warming of the central and eastern Pacific, east of the dateline, but all the way across to South America. And as a result, it's, you know, over a quarter of the tropics, the planet. It's a much larger area than the United States, for instance, that is warming with an El Niño event. And the other phase is a La Niña event, which is a cold phase of the phenomenon. Now, the best way to think of this is that what goes on in the ocean is the El Niño and La Niña. And in the atmosphere, the corresponding phenomena is primarily this thing called the Southern Oscillation, which was first discovered by Sir Gilbert Walker when he was trying to figure out what was going on in India around the early 1900s, for the most part. And he was the one that gave it this name, the Southern Oscillation. It was southern, of course, relative to Europe, but it's certainly centered in the tropics, although the southern hemisphere probably plays a stronger role than the northern hemisphere. And the reason is, in the northern hemisphere, there is the very large annual cycle associated with the heating up of land in the summertime and then cooling off with snows and cold in the wintertime, whereas in the southern hemisphere, it's dominated much more by the ocean, and there can be more continuity, more continuous variations in the weather and climate system, the coupling between the atmosphere and the ocean, and it has its primary ability to remember what has happened from one year to the next in the southern hemisphere. But this certainly extends to the tropical Pacific. And the biggest changes occur in the tropical Pacific in association with monsoons and the phenomena that we call convergence zones, the tropical convergence zone and the South Pacific convergence zone. These are the main rain bands over the ocean that move around with the El Niño phenomenon.
And there is an oscillation in the North Atlantic Ocean, and you cover that in your book. It impacts weather in the U.S., the Canadian Northeast, but especially Europe and Scandinavia. What should our listeners know about the North Atlantic Oscillation?
Well, the North Atlantic Oscillation also has a long history, and it was discovered at least 100 years ago. And it relates primarily to changes in the North Atlantic and over Europe and over the eastern parts of the United States. And during one phase, there are very strong westerlies and a southward displaced storm track that takes more warm, moist air into Europe and extends across even into parts of Asia. Whereas in the other phase, the storm track is further north. And so the main storms go into Europe in Scandinavia and affect Russia and so on. And at that phase, the Mediterranean and in Spain and Portugal and so on are very dry and may have heat waves and wildfires such as we've seen in recent times. That's one other phase of the North Atlantic Oscillation. it's unique to the Northern Hemisphere, this particular phenomenon, and it relates very much to the presence and the configuration of the continents, but Greenland plays a key role as well, and it relates to the disruption of any flows that would otherwise go from west to east, as it does more in the Southern Hemisphere, for instance. And so this is what we call a natural mode of variability, primarily in the atmosphere. It doesn't require an ocean component to exist, but the ocean does help it provide a little bit of memory.
But we should know that that is a natural phenomenon that's been observed for a long time, and it's not a result of global warming per se.
It's not, but some of the impacts are being affected by global warming, because what global warming does is when it's wet, it tends to be a bit wetter, and when it's dry, it tends to be a bit drier, and the heat waves are stronger and the wildfires are stronger. And so the natural variability sort of sets the stage, but the global warming aspect makes the things that are going on that stage a little bit exaggerated over what they would have been.
But you conclude that ENSO changes in the Pacific are much stronger drivers of global weather than the North Atlantic Oscillation?
Yes, the ENSO phenomenon is the primary mode, which we refer to as being coupled. That very much involves both the atmosphere and the ocean. And so as the easterlies, the trade wind easterlies in the tropical Pacific drive the ocean currents in the Pacific, it tends to build up more water over north of Australia and in the Indonesian region. And the warm water tends to accumulate there, as it's been doing now for the last couple of years. And eventually, and sea level gets higher. It gets more than a foot higher than it normally is over in that region. It tends to exaggerate some of the typhoons that occur in that region. And then eventually the system says, oh, I can't stand this anymore. And a lot of this water then flops across the Pacific, and we have an El Nino event, and it warms up in the central and eastern Pacific. The ocean is very much involved in this, and as the warm water moves eastward, a lot of the weather systems do as well, and we get a lot more activity in the central and eastern Pacific, and also, incidentally, a bit less in the Atlantic. And so that's what happens in an El Nino event. And the other phase, the La Nina phase, where it's cold in the eastern Pacific, there tends to be more hurricane activity in the Atlantic. And so it has consequences not just for the Pacific and the Pacific Rim countries, but also in the Indian Ocean and in the Atlantic as well.
We have so much to learn. Unlike the way most people in the media talk, you say there is no neutral state in the El Niño-La Niña cycle, and La Niña should really be plural. Could you talk to us about those things?
Well, yes, and so the average conditions in the tropical Pacific are very seldom observed. Instead, it's more like a teeter-totter, a seesaw, where we're going from El Nino to La Nina and then back again, and it's very much related to the conditions that get set up in the tropical Pacific between the winds and the sea temperatures and the changes in the ocean and sea level as a result. And if you're in one phase, then it's causing changes in the ocean that eventually cause it to flip back into the other phase, although the La Niña events can last longer. And we're, about to go into year three, which is very unusual of a La Niña event, whereas the El Niño events can be more intense and have bigger consequences. And the warmest years on record tend to be in the latter phase of the El Nino events. And so the last biggest El Nino event was 2015-2016, and the warmest year globally was 2016 still, although you know, 2021 was not very far behind, I have to say.
Talk to us about the relationships now between ENSO and climate change. We have this natural pattern probably going on for thousands of years, as we know, with ENSO. But now humans are rearranging everything with this energy flow that we talked about in our first interview. What drives what? How can we separate the two, or should we separate them?
Well, certainly a key question for scientists is how will El Niño change, or how will ENSO change as the climate changes? And I, you know, it's not that clear, but it's maybe a little bit like a lot of the weather systems as well. The natural variability, it's best to think of this as going along much as it always has. So El Niño will continue in terms of what's going on in the Pacific with regard to the interactions between the atmosphere and the ocean. But what global warming and climate change does is it changes the consequences. So the El Niño phenomenon is the biggest causes of where floods and where droughts occur around the world. And what happens when there are floods and droughts is are now worse because of the global warming aspect. And that's because the warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor. And in places where it's dry, usually on land, that's favored more in El Niño years. In particular, in places like Australia, Australia tends to be very dry and hot, and wildfires in Australia. The last modest El Niño event was 2019-2020 was when the last huge number of wildfires occurred in that region. Whereas the La Niña stage often has more rain on land, at least in the winter half year. But the La Niña phase also tends to push the storm tracks across North America a bit farther to the north. And so it tends to be drier and a bit warmer across the United States in La Niña events. And that's what we've seen in the last couple of years. And it's exacerbated the drought, especially in the southwest. It's when you have El Niño events that we're more likely to get a storm track that brings major rainfall events into the west coast and especially into California. But, you know, there's always exceptions. There was a little rainfall event in Death Valley just recently, for instance. But more generally, El Niños favor wetter conditions in California and farther to the east, all the way across to Florida, for that matter.
Do you think global warming will build in more chances of these superheating El Niño patterns?
That's a good question, and there's been some speculation about that. Our models, our climate models, are not quite as good as I would like to see in order to have real confidence in dealing with that particular question. And so I don't think we can answer that very well, but I think when we have an El Niño, the consequences are likely to be greater. And the next El Niño, which is, you can see the signs of it building up in the far western Pacific. The warm pool that normally exists around Indonesia and in that region has built up, and there is very warm water down to 200 meters or below 200 meters in the ocean, sort of waiting for the right conditions for the next El Niño to develop. But, you know, it takes a while to unfold. It takes several months to unfold, and we can actually track that now, and predictions of El Niño are pretty good for at least 6 months in advance, and the predictions for the coming winter are that we will be primarily in La Niña conditions. You know, beyond that, I think the odds are probably going to favor an El Niño beginning, say, March, April next year or something like that.
Just another small thing I noticed in your book, which could be big. You say ENSO and climate change team up to increase salty ocean deserts. And nobody's talking about this. Is ocean desertification an issue worth watching?
Well, yes. I was one of the, with some collaborators that analyzed what's happening to salinity And we have measurements, much better measurements, since about, well, the early 2000s. There's a lot of instruments in the oceans that are measuring salinity for the top 2,000 meters of the ocean, and we've been able to understand a lot better what is happening with the saltiness in the ocean. And what we've found is that, indeed, the salty areas are getting saltier, and the fresher areas are getting fresher. And so this relates to the general concept that the wet areas are getting wetter and the dry areas are getting drier. So it relates to this particular important role of water vapor and precipitation in climate change. And, you know, to some extent this is happening on land, but over land it gets complicated by the availability of water. You know, in deserts there's no water to play a role. But over the oceans, that signature is very clear. And so the salty areas are getting saltier. And when it's salty, that means the water is a bit denser. And so that water is more inclined to sink. And so it has an impact on ocean currents. And it can begin to affect things like the Gulf Stream, for instance. And there's a lot of speculation and worry about what might happen to the Gulf Stream as a consequence of these kinds of changes that are coming about in part because of climate change.
So we saw this summer of 2022 in the Northern Hemisphere, there were long-lasting, record-breaking heat waves along with drought and very extreme rainfall events, as we've talked about. And all this comes during a third year of La Niña. Will we not discover a whole new level of pain when a strong El Niño arrives again now that we've warmed Earth?
There's a number of people, and I think I would include myself in that, that speculate that this may well be the case. When the next El Niño occurs, the odds are high that we will break the record and indeed establish the next year that we have the highest global mean surface temperature around the world, sort of in the trailing phases of the next big El Niño event. But as a consequence, it means that heat is coming out of the ocean in an El Niño event. It pumps up all of the convection, all of the thunderstorms that occur, all of the hurricanes and typhoons around the world get pumped up by this. And during that, the rain that comes out of those, it warms up the atmosphere as the latent heat is released, and that contributes to this increase in the global temperatures in the atmosphere. And eventually, the atmosphere moves that heat around. It affects just about every part of the planet. But that heat eventually gets, some of that heat eventually gets radiated back to space. And so this is a part of the process of this overall flow of energy through the climate system that an El Niño is actually a means of cooling off the tropical Pacific Ocean, pumping the heat into the atmosphere, and the atmosphere moves it around and then moves it out to space. As it's doing that, of course, it's changing the weather systems. And some of these weather systems can be more extreme than anything we've ever seen before.
Your work helped define the ENSO system in many highly cited papers. What do you find most striking about it?
Well, that's a loaded question, and you can look at it from a physical standpoint. And the understanding has been increased. I was involved in a program that was called TOGA, the Tropical Oceans Global Atmosphere Program, where we first put moored buoys in the tropical Pacific to measure what was going on below the surface. And it was only then that we fully began to understand just what was happening in the Pacific and how it was happening. And that understanding has grown, and it's grown a lot more as we've had more satellite observations from space, especially of precipitation, rainfall, and also of sea level using altimeters in space. And we have tried to replicate that in various climate models. I think there is a broad understanding of why El Niño occurs, and I've tried to describe that a little bit here. But the ability to model all of the details is not there yet, and it relates to the complexity of things like typhoons and hurricanes and thunderstorms that are occurring on quite small scales, and yet we have to deal with global scales as well. And so computers have gotten bigger and faster and better, but they're still not quite bigger and better and fast enough yet to fully do all we need to do with regard to the El Nino phenomenon. And so there's some uncertainties there that still exist, and it's very important to keep this monitoring system in place. All of these moored arrays that have been led by the U.S., but contributed to by a number of other nations, the Japanese in particular, and also all of these floats that occur in the ocean, the so-called Argo floats, that are contributed to by about 49 different nations around the world, including New Zealand, where I am now. And New Zealand also plays a key role in helping to deploy these floats in different parts of the South Pacific, for instance. And so it's very much a collaborative activity. And one of the things which I have been quite involved in is trying to make sure that the importance of all of these observations is fully realized by the funders and the politicians, the agencies and so on, because tracking what is going on is what enables us to make more reliable forecasts 6 months ahead of time. And they probably still have scope to get a little bit better, but there are some unpredictable aspects that will limit how far we can go with El Nino forecasts. Probably ultimately 18 months is about as far as we can go in details because of the chaotic nature of weather.
From Auckland, we have been talking with Dr. Kevin Trenberth, distinguished scholar and a leader in world climate reports. Check out his new book, The Changing Flow of Energy Through the Climate System. You can find out more on my blog at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.